Welcome to Stepping Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and I'm really excited today to be speaking with the two people who are the regional coordinators for the Middle East Office of the American Friends Service Committee. You may know of the American Friends Service Committee. It does really wonderful work all over the world. So I want to welcome you, Suzanne Hamad and Tariq El-Bakri, and you're a couple, as well as being both coordinators of the AFSC. And you are of Palestinian origin. You, Tariq, are from, you said you grew up in Jerusalem. And Suzanne, well, let's just, you tell me about a little bit about yourself and how you came to be working at the AFSC. And now you live in Jordan, right? Mm-hmm. That's where the main office is of American mm-hmm. Friends Service Committee, mm-hmm. which is a Quaker-based peace and justice organization, for those who don't know.
Well, I was raised in Kuwait. I'm one of the Palestinians who my parents left Palestine in 1967 after the war, and I was born and raised there. And then we moved after the Second War, when Kuwait was invaded in 1990, to Jordan. And right now, like you said, our regional office is based in Jordan, but we work, we oversee AFSC's programs in West Bank, Gaza, Israel, Iraq, Lebanon, and Turkey. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's so much going on in the Middle East, and a lot of violence is happening there, as it is in so many places in the world, and it's really crucial for the whole planet, of course. Have you been an activist for a long time? Because I think of as the AFSC as an activist organization. How about you, Tariq?
I've been involved. I mean, politics in the region is, everyone breathes politics, and it gets into the into one's life and at every point. I've studied in a very interesting program, which if you want to consider can be part of the activism. I had my master's together with Israeli students in Palestine, and it was in the master's in peace and development studies that was sponsored by a Swedish university. So we studied a group of Palestinian, Israelis, and European students all together on peace and development. Mm-hmm. So that was quite an interesting program in which we learned more about democracy, human rights, civil societies, theories of peace and war, and development issues, conflict resolution issues. And then during that program, one gets to challenge many givens in his life and gets to learn a lot about the other side, and probably together we have agreed on so many things and disagreed on many other things, and probably we can together in the future be a small contribution to the peace movement on both sides in Palestine and Israel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think that's a big advantage, because it is the humans that make all these decisions that mostly don't listen to each other and often don't even know each other. So I imagine that's really helpful. So what work exactly are you doing in the American Friends Service Committee in the Middle East? You told me about the many countries.
Well, in the West Bank and Gaza, we have a Quaker Palestine youth program, that's the QPYP, and our focus is on youth. I'll actually read out the main objective that we have there, because it's based on a needs assessment that we did. and that is to challenge the consequences of all forms of isolation and discrimination imposed on Palestinian youth in the West Bank and Gaza, and to enable youth to take their role as responsible citizens in the democratization and community development processes and become proactive agents of social change. So this is the overall broad objective, and it was in response to our finding that since the Intifada and since the failure of Oslo, many, of course, on both sides, the aspirations and expectations of many young people crashed. And right now in Palestine, there's a large degree of despair and hopelessness and a very bleak perception of a future. So we try to challenge that isolation that has resulted from all the closures, from the cycle of violence, from the limited opportunities, and isolation in the sense, in many senses, geographical, educational. You have some kids not able to get to their schools because of the closures to universities. Psychological, there are boundaries of fear that young kids are growing up traumatized because of shelling that's happening every day in their communities. So we're talking about a wide range of isolation and its consequences, and we're one of the few organizations that work in that area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I know because I have access to information, I said I don't know much, but I certainly know a lot about the violence that the Palestinians are exposed to, and in the way we always every interview I do, I have to talk about the media, because the media is so important in informing or not informing people. And I would say that it's my impression that the American media is very biased and isn't really talking about what's happening to Palestinian people a lot. So any description that you can give about that will be probably very educational for the listeners.
Unfortunately, yeah, we agree. I mean, what we have noticed from our tour here in the U.S. and from our previous visits, that the media does not reflect the reality on the ground, which is, as Suzanne has just mentioned, very sad and very bleak. People are very hopeless and helpless at the same time. The trips that all of the West Bank now is scattered with checkpoints. People, if they want to travel from one place to another, they need to show their ID several times on one trip. The trips that used to take, I mean, if we want to talk about a 10-mile trip between Jerusalem and Ramallah, you have to cross 5 checkpoints in order to make that trip. And what used to take 10 minutes is now taking hours. People are being humiliated at every checkpoint. This feeling of humiliation and fear and anger is growing up among the Palestinians, unfortunately. The Israelis on the other side are also living in fear because of the suicide bombings. The economy is going back. There is a 60% unemployment rate among the Palestinians. Israel has lost since the outbreak of the violence something like $5 billion. It's a very sad reality for both people. They are both living in despair, and they are both trapped by the political rhetoric of their leaderships.
I just spoke to somebody last week who just come back from Israel, and I know that in Israel you can life goes on even though people are talking about politics and aware of the tension and everything, that life goes on and cafes or restaurants and jobs and everything are happening. And from what I've heard about life in the occupied territories, it's people can't, as you mentioned, Suzanne, even go to school or go to the store. Maybe you want to say a little bit more about that, and then we'll move off this topic.
Well, I'll give you a practical example of what checkpoints are doing. I mean, there's one of the biggest universities is in Birzeit, and that's 10 minutes away from Ramallah, another city. And there is a big checkpoint there, and because of a settlement that's in the vicinity. So university students have to go through that every day, and sometimes the checkpoint decides to close down for several weeks, and some university students take more than the average number of years to graduate. So recently, and I don't know if the American media reported that, but there was a peaceful demonstration, and lots of university students stood at that checkpoint, and along with university professors, with parents, several of the international community living in the occupied territories also participate in that because they're living under the same situation. And it was dispersed by tear gas, and there was shooting, and some people were injured in this peaceful demonstration. But it's an ordeal to get to do the basic, the normal things that you can do here. It's really a pain, and we perceive it as a collective punishment for what a minority of the population is doing, which we don't justify, but. Everybody is suffering, and it's not doing anything to improve the situation or bring both sides closer to peace. It's perpetuating the violence and really strangulating everybody. You have houses demolished in Rafah. There was 53 houses demolished. So many people still living in tents, homeless. In East Jerusalem, you have also houses demolished just at a sudden decision. I don't have statistics with me now, but around 850 Palestinians have been killed so far, and of them, around 30% are children. On the other side, you have 230 Israelis killed. This is a situation that needs to change. It's not, like Tarek just said, it's not any closer to a breakthrough, but we are one of the few organizations we work in partnership with peaceful, peace-loving, non-violent organizations on both sides, and we're hoping to challenge the situation and build the peace movement so that it can lead to a breakthrough.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the peace movement as it exists on both sides? And of course, we're not even talking. Maybe we should actually move over to Iraq, but let's talk a little bit more about Israel, the Israel-Palestinian conflict, and the prospects of peace, and any personal things you want to contribute is great too. Tarek?
At the beginning of the Intifada, I think the peace movements on both sides got confused for a while and how to deal with the situation, because it has never been, expected or planned. I think the Intifada has took everyone by surprise. The way it had erupted and how it developed and escalated. But by now, after almost 17 or 18 months of the Intifada, I think the peace movements on both sides has realized that something needs to be done to stop this madness of violence and retaliation and counter-violence that has been going on. There are, with facilitation of European and some American organizations and peace organizations, there has been organized 3 weeks of activities in the West Bank and Gaza, together with, of course, Israeli organizations, trying to send the message that enough is enough and people need to think about alternative ways in order to stop this violence and counter-violence and to promote going back to negotiations. There were representatives from many European organizations and Americans present in non-violent action against the occupation, and that was fully covered in the media. And I don't think such activities has been covered in the American mainstream media, unfortunately. But what we are seeking also is that it's very important for the Americans to play a role at the grassroots level among the people to show their solidarity with the peace movements in the ground, that there is something else. It's not only where people only perceive the American policy that is always biased against Palestinians. So it's very important for the people to stand in solidarity with the peace movement in Palestine and Israel, and to show their opinion and support to the peace initiatives over there. What people are only perceiving and seeing is the governmental policy level kind of standpoint. Mm-hmm. Helicopters, of course, they see the American helicopters, American bullets, and American government decisions and policy. What we need is they also need to see, to meet and to interact with people at a human level and see their solidarity. Yeah.
And they have, well, again, back to the media, of course, there's a lot of a narrowness of the media. And how much, do you know how much money that comes from the United States to Israel per day, per week? It's like, I think we give the most money, the United States government gives the most money to Israel of any country in the world, and basically it's to, looks to me like to perpetrate a lot of violence for whatever the reasons are. It feels like a very unfair fight, and that's my opinion from the information that I have. So I would like to go ahead.
Yeah, can I just, I'd like to air this. It's the 21st century, and there is still an occupation on this earth. And I think everybody, regardless of whatever ethnic group or religion or nationality, has a moral responsibility to get this to stop. And to always look at the root causes for anything and not take news or information at face value.
That sounds good. I want to remind the listeners that my guests are the coordinators of the regional coordinators for the Middle East of the American Friends Service Committee. They are Suzanne Hamad and Tariq El Bakri, and you live in Jordan. I understand a lot of the population of Jordan is Palestinian, and I'm wondering what it's like to live in Jordan, or what the politics of Jordan and Israel and the occupied territories and all that is.
I'll tell you a personal story. I mean, that would reflect how complicated the issue is. I was born in Jerusalem and raised over there, so I have a legal status in Jerusalem that is resident, which means that I'm not a full citizen. I don't have the civil rights that any citizen can enjoy somewhere else. Residency by nature is temporary. So if you prove that you live in Jerusalem, then you can stay in Jerusalem. But if you prove to be living somewhere else, then you should go somewhere else. Suzanne, my wife, was born in Kuwait, and she has a different legal status because her father fled the West Bank in 1967, and she cannot legally be in Jerusalem. She would be breaking the law because she always needs to permits. Now we started a family last July, and we needed to be together. So I had to move to Jordan. But also, when I'm in Amman, I cannot stay in Amman more than 3 months. Every 3 months I have to go somewhere and then renew my residency also in Amman, Jordan. So I have to renew my residency in Amman, and at the same time I have to prove that I am also existing in Jerusalem in order to maintain my residency. If I lose residency in both places, then I have nowhere to go. This is how life is for, Palestinians and Jordanians, how these personal stories can reflect the politics of the region. For me, as a Jerusalemite, I don't feel that I'm welcome in Israel and I'm not welcome in Jordan. But at the same time, I need to continue living my life as I wish. It's not for the politics to decide how am I going to live. I have to find my own ways in order to live my life the way I want to. It has been a very difficult reality for me. Politics has intervened in every turning point of my life. When I wanted to go to school, when I wanted to go to the university, and the Gulf War, it's a very difficult situation, and it becomes part of you. I mean, who I am is partially how the conflict has shaped me to be. And it's very interesting that as I have mentioned in the beginning of this interview, how the master's program in which we as Palestinians and Israelis and Europeans studied together has brought us to a common understanding of how the conflict has affected our lives, and how challenging it was for every one of us to see, to challenge these principles and the givens that he has been raised up with for all of his life. generally speaking, if we're talking about the politics in Jordan, it's also Jordan's situation is very delicate, and its position in the regional Arab context is also very, very delicate because it has signed a peace agreement, as we all know, with Israel, and at the same time, its population is around 60% or 70% populated by Palestinians. Mainly, the majority of them are refugees. And as long the Palestinian-Israeli conflict has always been of a major concern to the Jordanian government. As far as there is clashes between Palestinians and Israelis, the government finds itself in a very critical situation because at the governmental level it has signed an agreement, it is bound by agreement with Israel, but at the grassroots level and the populations, they are very angry with the situation on the ground, and they are very angry what is by the sufferings that their families and friends across the river in the West Bank are seeing. The Palestinian population in Jordan, of course, they're considered Jordanian citizens. They have equal rights as Jordanians, and this is how things are.
Okay. Thanks. Well, I think we're going to move on to the issue of Iraq here, and I think that this must be very enlightening for people, and we could talk for a very long time. So you work with...
Yes, we also work with Iraq. We have a relief program, basically, because very few NGOs are allowed to work in Iraq. And the programs that we have done so far have been renovating schools that were hit. And so we're providing access to school children to clean and healthy schools. We also contributed with the Campaign of Conscience, which started in the U.S. It's an advocacy program, and I'll let my colleague from AFSC San Francisco office talk more about that. What we did was five chlorinators were sent from the U.S., challenging the sanctions, and we facilitated getting it into Iraq to provide clean water for five hospitals. These are children's hospitals, HIV and tuberculosis, and general hospitals in several areas that now have very bad water and sanitation conditions. And I don't know if time permits, but to give an idea of how bad the water and sanitation situation is, we visited Iraq last year, myself and Tariq. And we went to the south, which is even more underserved and in worse condition than Baghdad or the center or the north. And we saw something that sticks to my mind, and I'd like to share that vision with you. There were trenches in front of each household. There's a long trench, and this trench is where the water, the sanitation, comes from each household and collects in the trench and then flows down God knows where. It really looks and smells bad. And what we saw was two children from one of the houses jumping into that trench. Imagine that. And they were trying to unblock the hole that delivers the sewage into the trench. And now, if you can imagine the consequences of that, the epidemics that are coming back, like very old epidemics that were killed many years ago, and the children, I mean, you have cancers. The number of at birth deformities and cancers has increased fourfold in 1 year. Mm-hmm. And this is because of the depleted uranium impact and the water and sanitation situation. So it's pretty bad, and that's where our focus as AFSC has been, water.
And I just want to say that I hear a lot of stories about Iraq, which is, of course, have everything to do with the constant bombing by the United States and the depleted uranium bullets. And I hear about babies born with no mouths and no brains. And and most Americans have no idea this is even going on, so we're going to run out of time soon.
Hey, my name is Jeff Grubler, and I'll tell you a little about the Campaign of Conscience. I just started volunteering with the American Friends Service Committee. But like Suzanne said, that it's a humanitarian relief program. It actually provides water treatment things, rebuild schools, and so forth. what the campaign is multi-leveled. We collect money from people and signatures, the money to do this, to buy the infrastructure, to repair their infrastructure. And we get people to sign these petitions saying that they are knowingly violating the sanctions, that they're violating the law, and even putting themselves at risk. And it's a big awareness campaign because people are saying, hey, wait, I'm rebuilding a school or a water treatment plant, and I could go to jail for this. This is illegal. And so we're challenging people on that level. And then we're using those signatures to present them to Congress people and so forth. So it acts in lobbying as well as awareness, and provides safe drinking water, schools, and infrastructure for people. So it's a great campaign. The American Friends Service Committee is involved in many great campaigns. You can check it out on www.afsc.org, as well as a blanket campaign for Afghanistan and loads of other great things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, like I said, it's a great organization, and you have plenty of things to do these days. Tariq, we just have a couple minutes left, so were you wanting to say something, Tariq?
I mean, the main message that I wanted to share with you is that people need to try to seek alternative sources of information for them to know the reality, how it is on the ground. It's very important, for, as we have noticed from our trip, that people know only the face value of things, but they need to seek knowledge in order to understand how things are happening, and not to be judgmental from the very preliminary investigation, I would say.
I think maybe I'll use this opportunity to put a word in for the Indie Media. You can also go to www.indymedia.org. And there's 75 sites all over the world, and I think that you'll get some information there, too, on the Internet, and as well as listening to the radio here. Have you been to the United States before?
Yeah, several times. Mm-hmm.
And what's happening with media in where you live? Is there any independent media, or is it pretty controlled?
Well, in Jerusalem, I would say it has been controlled. I think it's somewhere in the middle. Some few things are controlled, and others are quite free. But I mean, generally speaking, probably this is a concern of the indie media also. There is no very free, all the time free media anywhere in the world. So many times it is being controlled, whether by economic or political factors. But I would say that we have some sort of a fair kind of media.
I think the new satellite channels, they're offering an independent, non-governmental form of media, and this is really mobilizing the Arab world and providing non-controlled forms of information, especially Al Jazeera, which you may have heard about during the Afghanistan war. They covered a lot of things that we would have never heard about on other sources of media. And one thing, just to add to what Tariq said and to confirm, is something we noticed here is CNN International is very different from CNN domestic. Yes, we noticed a difference in reporting the same event. The amount of information, the amount of coverage is extremely, it was different. So
wasn't the transmitter from Afghanistan for Al Jazeera bombed by the U.S.?
Yeah. Yeah, it was. So are you saying they get more information, the international folks get more information?
It's different. It's just different. The level of information is different. So we just encourage people to look into further information to cover the whole picture.
Okay, well, our time is up. I want to thank you very, very much, Suzanne Hamad and Tariq El-Bakri and Jeff Grubler, all from the American Friends Service Committee, the first two folks from live in Jordan, and they're coordinators of the AFSC Regional Office, Middle East Office. And Jeff is here in San Francisco, and my name's Sue Supriano. Thanks very much for listening.